exciting to think about. That's the thing that we should get most excited about, is what Jesus and what he's doing for us in our lives and what he's doing in our hearts. So once again, we're in 2 Samuel tonight, chapter 18, as we continue on through this book. A lot of great things we can learn. We're actually going to look at the battle of David's forces versus Absalom tonight. Sometimes when you come to a story, it's just good to read the story and just give you some commentary in it and then give you some final thoughts at the end. So that's kind of what we're going to do, is just kind of walk through the story. It's going to look at the whole chapter tonight. I think there's a lot of good, interesting things we can learn out of it, too. I think that, but instead of digging into one certain point like we did last week and looked at the three verses about doing good to others, we're just going to look at the whole entire chapter and just kind of highlight a couple of things that I think God can work and speak to our hearts about and help us in this thought that David goes to battle against Absalom. Give you a little commentary here. Remember, David's son Absalom is the one who has killed his brother Amnon because Amnon raped Absalom's sister, his half-sister. Absalom goes and leaves. David doesn't allow him to come back to Jerusalem for years. Then Absalom is allowed to come back. David doesn't want to see him for a period of time, and then that kind of all works out. Then Absalom begins trying to steal the hearts of the people. And so Absalom steals the hearts of many of the people of Israel. Absalom tries to start a rebellion. He takes over Israel, becomes the king of Israel for a short period of time, and David flees out into the wilderness. And there's a battle that's brewing. It's going to be a civil war. And it's not just Judah versus Israel anymore. It's people from Judah and people from Israel both that have gone with David. They're out in the wilderness getting ready for this battle. Absalom is now getting his battle ready. Absalom's army will be much bigger than David's army is, but we see Absalom being the aggressor is heading out because Absalom wants to put David to death. David as the king, once again, this is his father. David as the king, he needs to be put to death, so Absalom actually becomes king and ruler, and there is no question about David coming back to take over the kingdom. So you see these two wars, these two battles are getting ready to happen. The sad thing you see is a civil war is family member against family member in some areas. You'll even see later on when we see who Absalom picked as his captain. You know, he is a family member of some of the people who David has as some of his captains. And it's no fun. War is not fun. Sometimes it is necessary. But as we're considering, as we're reading it, I think there's some spot in here that says that 20,000 people lost their lives. I mean, 20,000 people. There's just a lot of interesting things, some thought-provoking things, things if you're interested in studying more, we're going to leave you with, kind of whet your appetite and give you some things to think about scripturally and prayerfully. And I think there's some things that we can take out of tonight's message that we can learn and grow from and apply to all of our lives. So let's go ahead and start off here in 2 Samuel chapter 18. We're going to start in verse number 1. And David numbered. So verses 1 through 4, if you're going to take an outline, we don't always use an outline, but we're going to try to keep track here on the outline. Verses 1 through 4 would be called the companies for the war. The companies for the war. And David numbered the people. You see here that he's organizing his company. He numbered the people that were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. And I'm thankful that that's there because most of us would think that David's mighty men is there and not many else. But you see there's hundreds and thousands that are there. Josephus says it's probably around 4,000 or 5,000 people. How does he know that? I don't know. But that's what the historian says. It's a much smaller army than what Israel would have. And David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab. Now, this is a little bit different here. Joab has been demoted in a sense because Joab usually is doing what David would do. He is the commander. He is the captain. Joab usually is in charge of the entire army. Instead, David has taken this role, and David has put a third under Joab, a third part under Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and a third part under the hand of Ittai, the Gittite. Now, we learn about the Gittite back in chapter number 15, he's in Philistines area. He has pledged his allegiance to David. And the king said unto the people, I will surely go forth with you myself also. So you see how he organized it in verse number 2. He also says, I'm going to go with you. Now, in verses 3 and 4, they convinced David he should not go. Look what it says. But the people answered, "Thou shalt not go forth. If we flee away, they will not care for us. Neither if half of us die will they care for us. But now thou art worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, now it is better that you succor us out of the city." So he says, you need to stay back. They're not interested in us. They don't care about us. They want only you. And the king said unto them, "What seemeth you best, I will do." And the king stood by the gate side, and all the people came out by hundreds and by thousands. So first thing, a little nugget you can take out of here is David is the king, David is the leader, but David is also going through a very difficult and hard time. His own son has rebelled against him. His own son has committed immorality with those 10 concubines. His own son is seeking to kill him. He's a very emotional state. He listens to those, even though that they're in a lower position, he has wisdom to listen to the multitude of counselors. And just because you have authority or just because you're the one in charge does not mean you cannot learn from those people that are there to help you. And God gives these three very skilled captains. We know Joab has much skill. We learn about Abishai a little bit, and we don't know much about this other man, Ittai, but as he is known for being a general. So they listen. David reviews the armies. David should not have been in the battle. David was saying, let's show kindness and gentleness to Absalom. We're going to look at that in a second. So David, in all reality, would not, on the battlefield, be caring about those that are around him. He would not be a good leader on the battlefield. Instead, he'd be looking for one person, that's Absalom. And the reason why, he's interested in what? He's interested in making sure Absalom is okay. David's heart is not in the right space to be a leader and to be a warrior at this moment in time. Instead, there's two armies that are getting ready to attack. One army is looking for David because they want to kill David. David over here is telling his army, deal gently with Absalom. Let's look what it says in verse number 5. So that's the companies of war that gets kind of showing you how they got things worked out, how they gotten everything in three different forces. It talks about how one person go to the left, one person go to the right, the other person go in the center, the same way that Gideon did with his 300 men, is a tactic of war. Remember, David is a skilled man, a skilled warrior. He has intelligence when it comes to this. Also remember, Joab has been in many battles. Abishai has been in many battles. Ittai has also been in many battles. You say, what's the big deal about it? Absalom doesn't have that. Absalom does not have those political warriors type guys like David has. Let's keep on going. Verse number 5. And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, said, deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. So this is the second point, is the command for the war. David is telling them, hey, look, make sure you deal gently with Absalom. Now there's two schools of thoughts here. You know, he's a father. He wants, obviously, his son to be, he doesn't want his son to be killed. But we got to remember who this rebellion is. Absalom is the one that's rebelling. Absalom is the one that's caused all these troubles. Absalom is going to be the cause of these 20,000 people. He's the one that went and stole the hearts of the people. He's the one that killed his brother Amnon. He's done wickedly. He needs to be punished. And David is saying, and he's even kind of crippling his army by saying, hey, deal gently with them. Because once Absalom's dead, the revolt is going to be over, the rebellion's going to be over, Absalom needs to be put to death. And in this way, it seems like it is a corrupted command. He is not helping his army. Instead, he is telling his army, hey, look, make sure Absalom is not killed. Absalom was a murderer. He was completely unrepentant. We saw what he did with the concubines. We saw what he did about taking over the kingdom. And one of David's glaring sins, and we see this obviously with Bathsheba, what happened, but one of his glaring sins is how he dealt with his sons. We don't see him correcting his children like, and you'll see this in a couple of areas, he didn't correct Absalom about killing Amnon. Well, he was justified. Well, he didn't correct Amnon. If he would have corrected Amnon and punished Amnon, then Absalom wouldn't have felt like he had to. He said, where is it coming? He's a softy when it comes to discipline. And when it comes to discipline and when it comes to the area of discipline, it's coming to the spot. He's saying, look, I know he's going to try to kill me, but I don't want you to hurt him. There's a problem there. And it's something that I think when we consider in the day and time we live in, we see that as a problem in some of the homes today. You know, sometimes parents want to be so kind and gentle. And once again, I think we should be full of mercy, but also full of truth inside our homes. Sometimes you see parents out there that do not want to correct their children. You see them in the grocery store sometime. You got a little kid, they're in the line, they put the candy there, the kid's screaming and crying because they want that piece of candy. The parent says, no, no, no. And in all reality, they give in to them, gets to get them to be quiet. And, you know, they don't want to correct them. They do not want to discipline them. And it's something that, you know, even spanking is something that's considered a horrible and cruel thing today. And David here has not restrained his children in some of the areas, and it's going to come back to haunt him. Later on in 1 Kings, there's one son who says that David never restrained him. He tried to take over the kingdom, even though Solomon was the one that was anointed to be it. You see it as something that's coming in here. Amnon wasn't corrected. Absalom has not been dealt with, and he's even telling his generals, don't kill him. So I think we can learn from this that we need to be careful in the fact that we, yes, are merciful and gentle and kind, but in the same thing, weakness when it comes to doing what's right has caused a lot of problems. It caused the problems with chastisement in the homes. It's caused problems in the courts. Criminals today are given very lenient sentences to where they'll continue on doing the crimes over and over and over. In classrooms, you see disruptiveness in classrooms where students seem to have more rights than a teacher, and students seem to have more rights than a parent. They seem like they're pampered more than they are discipline, and what is that going to raise? It's going to raise a generation where everybody feels entitled, and when they feel entitled, they feel like they can do whatever they can do. Like Absalom, he was entitled, and when Absalom was entitled, he felt like he should take over the kingdom, and he was justified in his own mind. So it's important. You see a lesson here. David is saying, hey, I want to deal gently, and I understand it. I can understand from a heart, from a father, that they want things to be right, and they want things to get good, and they want things. I understand why they want him to be captured and not killed, but David the people are going to fight for him, and the warriors are going to fight for him, and some people who are going to die for him. I care more about Absalom than I do about you, and there's something to consider at least. Even in our churches, there are some people who are tolerated to misbehave and act wrongly, and that hurts and hinders the cause of the work of God. And I'm not a confrontational guy. I'm not. I don't like doing that. Some people they thrive on it, and some preachers even do. You know, they like to talk about people and call up people from the pulpit and things like that. That's just not my style. That's not the way I'm wired. But there are times when I have to approach somebody and say, you know, what's happening here is a hindrance to the church. This is something we need to work on. This is something we need to consider. And lots of times people do not enjoy that. Lots of times people, especially someone who is prideful, will be against that. And hearing the reasoning of a pastor or someone who is in leadership at the church. And Absalom here had been kind of coddled. He was allowed to do this and allowed to do that. And yes, David didn't let him come to Jerusalem, and that made Absalom even more angry. And there's different things, but you see here in the story, and we might even develop a whole message out of looking at the different sons of David and how David was punished for his sin inside his own home. And part of the reason why is because he did not want to do the responsibilities of a father. And now he has come to this spot as king to save his nation. He needs to put Absalom to death, or Absalom needs to die in the battlefield to stop all the wars. But he's telling his own generals, don't do that. He's kind of cutting their feet off. He's saying, I don't want you to do that. And let's see what happens here. Let's see who wins the battle. I think you guys all know who wins the battle, but let's see how it comes about. Let's look at the circumstances in the war. The circumstances. Look at verse number 6. So the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the wood of Ephraim. And verse number 8, skip down there. For the battle was scattered over the face of all the country, and the wood devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Now, in my mindset, what I'm seeing here is that they come out to David. It doesn't say specifically which battlefield or which forest. It does say the wood of Ephraim. David's men are known for when they were, Saul was chasing them, that group is still there. They're known for their wisdom and their ability to fight the battles. And they'd been divided up. It says it was scattered all abroad. And as this war and this battle is going on, some's on the left, some's on the right, some's in the center. So they took this large army, they scattered them all abroad. But it says the wood, the trees, the thickets, the forest, they weren't used to fighting in this type of warfare, but these other men had some knowledge, at least the leaders had knowledge on how to fight this way and fight in this warfare. And it says that more people died because of the wood than the sword that day. And I think that was partly because the Lord allowed David's battle to win. So that's the circumstances in the war. Look at the combating in the war. Verse number 7, where the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David, and there were there a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. Now, 20,000 men in one day, that's a huge number. But remember, these are God's chosen people. These are the Israelites. Each of them had a mom and dad. Each of them maybe had families. Don't just read over that number. That's where sin takes you, and that's when you allow to be deceived by the devil as when he tries to steal the hearts of the people. Absalom was promising. He went up to him and says, if I were judge, if I were king, I would do this for you, and I would do this for you. Oh, that I was judge. Oh, and that's what the devil does. He tries to come and steal your hearts. If you listen to me, I'm going to give you this, and I'm going to give you that, and I'm going to do this for you. It's like we got elections coming up. That's what all the politicians say, all the things we want to hear. But look what happens in the end. They're laying dead in the forest, and the war, the battle, they're gone. Where's the promises of Absalom? He can't make good on them, and he, even though he stole the hearts of the people, he could not deliver. So look what it says in verse number 8, for the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country. We see the ingenious or the working of David by dividing up the men and sending them out. But we see that they were not familiar with the territory. The wood devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. So let's now look at the climax of the war, verses 9 through 18, the climaxes. And Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under a thick boughs of a great oak, and his head got caught hold of the oak, and he was taken between the heaven and the earth, and the mule that was under him went away. I don't know much about war battles back in Israel times. Some of the commentators are making fun of the fact he's riding a mule. That really isn't a proper animal to go into a battle with, but I don't really know if it is or not, because I just wasn't a warrior back then. But the commentators made a big deal of the fact that that's not the right animal to be in that area in that time. Now, you read this scene, what it sounds like that Absalom is, his head gets caught amongst the trees. And you can tell where it sounds like his body is in a standing form between heaven and earth. So I'm thinking that it means that his feet are not touching the ground. Now, if you go back to Sunday school stories, some Sunday school stories would say, remember he had that long flowing hair, and as he was riding along on his mule, which I don't think mules go very fast, his hair got caught up in the trees. We've heard that before. It says his head, hair is part of the head, whether maybe his head got stuck up in those branches, and he got to the point where he could not get himself out, and he's there, and he is hanged in that oak. Verse number 11, and verse number 10, It says a certain man saw it. So one of Joab's soldiers, one of the guys that were supposed to be with Joab, he sees it, and he told Joab and said, behold, I saw Absalom hanged in an oak. Joab says something that's interesting. Joab, we're going to probably do a study sometime before we get to 1 Kings on who Joab is, why David listens to Joab so much, why David gives so much leeway to Joab. I think Joab was the one that was there when Uriah was put to death. Joab knows that David killed and murdered Uriah. No one else knew that. So I think Joab always had a little bit of a hold on him. And verse number 11, and Joab said unto the man that told him, and said, behold, thou sawest him. Why didst thou not smite him there to the ground? I would have given thee 10 shekels of silver and a girdle. And I know you're saying, girdle? What man wants a girdle? Well, that was actually a signification of making him a captain or a leader in the battle that was there. And in this story, he says, why didn't you kill him? He was right there. And verse number 12, the man explains, David told us not to kill him. I'm not going to touch him. And that's what the man said unto Joab, though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand. He says, if you gave me all the money in all the world, yet would I not put forth my own hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king charged thee and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware that none touch young man Absalom. So he's obeying the king. He's listening to the king. Joab says, you should have killed him. So what happens now? Otherwise, I should have wrought a falsehood into my own life, for there is no matter hid from the king, and thou thyself wouldest have set thyself against me. He's saying to Joab, you would have killed me if I would have done that. You would have punished me. He says, I'm not going to do that. Let's look how Joab responds. Then said Joab, I may not tarry thus with thee. And he took 3 darts in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. So as the story is going, Absalom's there, he's hanging, he takes 3 darts. Bible times, the Hebrew word is not specifically say what these darts are. We think they're probably small spears or small knives. He takes them and he thrusts them through the heart. You can see the skillness of Joab in this battle, in this war. He does not regard what David says. He does not care what David says. He does what he thinks is right. He's disobeying the king. He's disobeying the leader. So he is doing wrong here, but he thinks he's justified because David's command for the war was something that he should not have had to listen to. We see the soldier was willing to respect it. He was not. So he takes these 3 darts, and Joab said, I may not tarry thus with thee. You know what he's saying? I don't want to talk to you about it. He's saying to the soldier, you're telling me that David said this. I'm not going to tarry with you. I'm not even going to discuss it. You ever dealt with someone like that? Someone's coming up to you. Hey, what you're doing is wrong. You should not be doing these things. I'm not even going to talk to you about it. Don't even want to hear it. I want to be able to say my opinion, but I don't want to. That's what the Joab's saying. You can have your opinion. That's fine, but I'm not even going to talk to you about it. He goes and he throws his 3 darts, his 3 knives, or his 3 spears. And then you see here that the life is still in him. It says, verse number 15, and the 10 young men that bear Joab's armor, must have had a lot of armor, but he, you know, the 10 men that were there that was following him, meeting his needs, come pass about and smote Absalom and slew him. So they seemed like they made a circle around him and probably punished him with beating him and beat him to death. So verse number 16, and Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing after Israel, for Joab held back the people. So they were winning. They were going to continue on punishing those in Israel. Joab says no. The trumpet was blown, and they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit in the wood. So they don't even preserve his body. They throw him in a pit. They laid a very great heap of stones. They were not going to allow someone to make a memorial of this rebellious person. They did what they thought was right upon him. And all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. Verse 18 is kind of an interesting verse there. It gives you a little bit of a background on Absalom. Now, Absalom in his lifetime had taken and reared up for himself a pillar. So he had made himself a pillar, which is in the king's dale. And he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name. Now, if you go back, I believe it's in chapter 14, maybe even in verse number 7, it says Absalom had 3 sons. So between this time that he had the sons and now at this point in time, all 3 of those sons must have been put to death or died. We don't know anything about it, but he's saying he doesn't have any children. Even as king, he would not have someone to take over his throne and his heir. And he called the pillar after his own name, and it was called unto this day Absalom's place. So there's a pillar there, shows how much pride he had, and no one else is going to take his name. So instead, he just turns around and makes his own pillar. Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. Now, we remember Ahimaaz is the son of Zadok. Zadok is the priest. They're the ones, one of the guys who carried the message to David from that spy that David had inside the court. He's saying, let me now run and bear the tidings how that the Lord have avenged him of his enemies. So he sees what's going on. He wants to go give David a report. He is a friend of David's. As you look at this, he does not respect Joab very much. He wants to tell the story. He wants to be the first one to do it. And Joab said unto him, thou shalt not bear tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another day. He says, no, you're not going today. But this day thou shalt not bear no tidings, because the king's son is dead. Then said Joab to Cushai, go tell the king what thou hast seen. And Cushai bowed himself unto Joab and ran. So you see, Cushai treats Joab with respect. He listens to the battle. He listens to the instruction. Ahaziah, or Ahazamazay, did not do that. You don't see him bowing. He does not listen to instructions. And then he says in verse 22, "Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, get again to Joab. But howsoever, let me, I pray thee, also run after Cushai." And Joab said, "Wherefore wilt thou run, my son, seeing that thou hast no tidings ready?" I don't know if Ahimaaz does not know about Absalom being dead. You're going to see here in a second, he's going to tell David he doesn't know. But earlier, and it says something about in verse number 20, the reasoning that he does not want Ahimaaz going. Verse 23, "But howsoever," said he, "let me run," once again, a third time, he's going to his commanding officer and says, "Please let me do this. Please let me." He kept on saying no. And he said unto him, "Run." Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and overran Cushai. And David sat between the two gates and the watchmen. And so we went from the climax of the war to the communicating of the war. And David sat between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate unto the wall and lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running alone. And the watchman cried and told David. And the king said, "If he be alone, there is tidings in his mouth." And he came apace and drew near. Now, so if there was a large army that was fleeing to the city, that would have meant defeat. That meant that they were looking for refuge. Because it's one individual person, they know he has something to tell them. He has a message. They call it tidings in his mouth. Verse 26, "And the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called unto the porter and said, Behold, another man running alone. And the king said, He also bringeth tidings. And the watchman said, Methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." Once again, Zadok, the priest, David's friend. And the king said, "He is a good man and cometh with good tidings." He did not treat Joab with respect, but David has a high respect for him. And Ahimaaz called and said unto the king, "All is well. All is well, and he fell down to the earth upon his face. He's bowing before David, but did not bow before Joab, before the king, and said, "Blessed be the Lord thy God, which have delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king." And now look at David's response. Look what David's interested in. David wants to know about Absalom. "Is the young man Absalom safe?" And Ahimaaz answered, "When Joab sent the king's servant and me the servant, I saw a great tumult, and I knew not what it was." So this could be the reason why Joab says, "I don't want you to go, because you don't know about Absalom." And of course, he could be lying here just to protect David's feelings. But we keep on going, verse number 30. "And the king said unto him, Turn aside and stand here. And he turned aside and stood here. And behold, Cushai came, and Cushai said, Tidings, my lord the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose up against thee." He says, it's a good day. All those that are trying to be your enemies are been avenged. Verse number 32, "And the king said unto Cushai, Is the young man Absalom safe? And Cushai answered, The enemies of my lord the king, and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is." So he's saying to him, he died, and he deserved to die. Look at David's reaction here. Verse number 33. "And the king was much moved, and went into the chamber above over the gate and wept. And he went, thus he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son." I think we're going to stop their reading, but there, verse number 33 is where I like to spend just a few minutes thinking about something. So he is moved. Now, as king, what he should have been doing is sitting in the gate. And he should have been saying to the men as they were coming back, "Congratulations, you did a good job. Thank you for fighting. Thank you for," that's what a good leader, that's what a good king would have done. He is moved by the death of his son so much, and he goes out and he cries out, "Oh, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee." I began thinking about that a little bit and thinking about the grief that David has and the mourning that David has. And I try to connect it with being around some people that, you know, being a pastor for a little while now, I've been around people that have mourned people's death. And it is amazing the difference between a person that is a Christian and on their way to heaven and know that they're on their way to heaven, and the family that knows and understands God and knows and understands where the way they mourn, versus someone who is unsaved or an unbeliever around someone who has whether they went to heaven or hell, how they mourned. If we have confidence in understanding and knowing that, you know, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, we can rejoice when someone who's been in pain and agony, we're going to miss them. We're going to be sorry that they're gone, but they're in a better place. We can rejoice in that. David here in this story, I think he has great grief and great mourning because he probably understands because of Absalom's actions and because he's defied the living God so many times that Absalom's heart's not right. That Absalom probably is not going to be in heaven someday. He has been very wicked in his life and he's done very much wrong. Never put his faith in the God of David. And I think that David sees in this story his fault in this. The sin that happened back in when Samuel was telling him that it was not going to, the sin, the punishment was not going to depart from his house, and that he's seeing this as partly because he has done wrong. He's seeing that he never restrained Absalom, and he didn't restrain Amnon, he didn't restrain his other sons, and they grew up to be wrong and they grew up to be bad, and his grief was, oh, that I would have died in his place. But think about the kingdom. If Absalom would have been the one who became king and stayed king, think about the wickedness that would have happened there. Think about all the difficulties the nation would have had under Absalom and unbelievers. David is mourning here because he's regretting the way he has lived. He's regretting his sin. He's seeing how this sin is applying to the fact that Absalom is dead and Absalom has rebelled. He doesn't seem like he cares about the 20,000 that has died out in the woods. Of course, he wouldn't have known the number, but it would have been a great slaughter out in the woods. He's worried and he's grieving here, and his heart's become so grieved, saying, I wish I would have died instead of Absalom. But that would not have helped the nation. That would have not helped the country. That wouldn't have been what was best. And you say, Pastor, how can I apply this to my heart and my life? Well, I think the way that when we come to the end of our lives someday, sometimes we have regrets. I don't know about you, but there's times when we wish we looked back on the years and wish we would have done something differently. We said, why do we learn from that? That we don't live a life that we will regret someday. That we grow and we say, you know, I might have made a mistake before in the past, but praise the Lord, God has forgiven me for it. Praise the Lord that I can continue on. Praise the Lord, I'm not going to be held back by that. But I want to spend the rest of my life not living a life that I'm going to regret. If I have not been a witness before in the past, you know, if I haven't talked to that person before, if I haven't told my family before in the past, you know, what I can do today, I can start telling them. If there's something that I wish that I would have done differently last year, I can start doing it today. I don't want to live my life and regret, be at the end of my life and regret the relationship that I had with individuals and with my family. I don't want to live the rest of my life and then at the end of my life, and I sat there, I sat next to some of the most godly people I've ever known and said, I wish I would have done this better. But you know what? I did my best after I realized what I was doing wrong. And they wish that they would have told so-and-so, or they wish they very rarely would ever talk about, I wish I had more possessions, I wish I had more money, or I wish that I would have spent more time pursuing after things. They're saying at the end of their life, I'm thankful for everything I did for God. I'm thankful for all the things that I served at doing. I missed those times of service. I'm thankful for all the people I led to Christ. I'm thankful for all the things that I gave, even though sometimes I sacrificed. I'm thankful that I had a godly husband, a godly wife. I'm thankful I have children that want to serve the Lord. And all those different things. And I know that all of them doesn't turn out that way. And I've sat at the next to the bed of people who I believed that were godly, and they would tell me, I wish my kids were right with the Lord. I wish when they were younger, I would have done things differently. I've heard those things. I think they would tell us today, make sure you're doing things so that doesn't happen. I think they would come back and say, make sure you have the right testimony and the right motives and the right service. Make sure you're serving for the right reason. You have the right attitude, and that it's not about you, and it's not about, I think that David here is mourning because he sees that Absalom was wicked, and he feels he had a part in that because of the sin with Bathsheba. He has a part in that because his grief is so great because he did not raise him properly. He had a part in that because he did not punish Amnon, and it put Absalom in a spot where he became bitter and put Absalom in a spot where he killed Amnon. Over and over, I think he's mourning it, and he becomes at a point and he says, I wish I would have died in this place. But you can't. And you can't change what happened in the past. But you can change it today. And you can make a difference. So when I see the mourning and the grief that is going through in chapter, in verse number 33 for David, I see a heart that is broken. It is his son. Of course he's going to be grieving. Of course he's going to be sorrowful. Of course he would be an uncompassionate father not to feel at least something for his son. I'm not saying he should. But what I'm saying is when you see the grieving there, we should look at a life and say, that's not the way I want to grieve someday. I don't want to live a life of regret. I don't want to live a life where I was, as we looked at earlier, too soft, that I gave in. I didn't serve the Lord. I should have done more. I don't want to live that life. And I can change that today. So you read the heart of David, and it continues on in chapter number 19. We might look at it a little bit next week, that he's sitting there, he's mourning. Joab comes in, and Joab rebukes him about not being out there to greet the army. And you can see how they come back into Judah, and they come back into the palace, and they do all these things. And you're going to see Shimei again. We're going to see Mephibosheth again. We're going to, like we saw, the Brazilian-like guy again. All those things we've looked at and mentioned already a little bit in past weeks. But look at his mourning. Look at his grief and say, I don't want to have those regrets at the end of my life. You know how you change that? You change that today. I don't know if I really came across a person that's ever said, I don't regret anything I ever did. And I would wonder about that statement. But I've never heard many people who've lived for God said, I regret the things I did for God. I regret spending so much time in the Bible. I regret not praying so much. I regret investing in children and investing in godly friends. I don't hear people saying, I invest in giving people the gospel. I don't see people saying that. I see people more saying, I wish I would have done more of this and more of that and less of this and less of that. This I can carry on. This leaves me a good testimony. This is going to cause people to go to heaven. This is going to say, the Lord's going to say, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Over here, it might have produced some things in this world, but over here, that doesn't matter as much. David was able to give his sons pretty much anything they wanted. But in the end, he sees his son in war be killed, and his heart's broken because he sees the mistakes he's made. I wonder if David learns from those mistakes. We're going to see that in the chapters to come. There are some times when David messes up again. But if you look in this study, I see David here from now on out. He seems like he's a broken man. It has something to do with the sin from Bathsheba. He's never been the same since Bathsheba. There was a spot where you could tell his heart was right, and things were going good and things were going right. But from here on out, you're going to see the rest of his life, I think he's regretting these things that happened. You're going to regret our sin someday. You're going to regret, I wish I would have done more when I had the capability of doing it. How do we switch that? We change it today. We start doing the best we can for the Lord today. And yes, we might regret some things in the past, but we don't have to regret from this day on forward. We can serve him with all our heart, even today. Let's go ahead and stand to our feet. With heads bowed and eyes closed for a time of invitation. David goes off to war and battle. We learn about the organizational skills. We learn about being willing to listen to people that have our best interest at heart and give godly counsel. We learned about not being soft, doing the responsibilities that God has given us and being responsible for the things that God's given us. We also learned about that message that Ahimaaz gave. It was half-informed, didn't want to give the truth. And lots of times people do that with their messages. They're not supposed to go, and they shouldn't, and they just give half a message.